This audio fiction is recorded for an adult audience. It may contain scenes of explicit sex, violence, and disturbing supernatural entities. Listener discretion is recommended.
Come, lend me your ear, as I speak to you of the macabre, the cursed, the maligned, the malignant, the possessed, and the downright demonic. Bolt all doors, lock all windows. Are you alone? Are you sure? I suggest you check under the bed, carefully, twice. Did you check deep in the wardrobe, behind the clothes? Are you in bed yet? Did you turn off the lights? They will come soon. They will follow my voice. But it will also keep them at bay, most of them. For some of you, there is no hope. You know who you are. Prepare to be whisked away to lands ancient and modern, familiar and far away. Prepare to question where fiction ends and fact begins. My name is DJ Swales. This is my horror and gothic horror audio fiction podcast. I'm the author of Baratonak, book one in my Fitzmarbury Witches series. The entire novel series came to me in a dream, waking me at 3 a.m. in a small bare writing room I'd rented in Bloomsbury, next door to Bob Marley's old apartment. In 2012, I gave up my London job, home, and mothballed all my worldly belongings to embark on 8 nomadic years of travel, risking everything to chase my dream of becoming a writer. But my dream became an obsession. I wrote 5 million words of prose and hundreds of spontaneous poems in decaying cafes, dusty bookshops, and decrepit hotels. During these 8 years, I journeyed from Istanbul to India, from Beverly Hills to Borneo, from St. Petersburg to Peru, but I published nothing until now. My only constant companion on my exhaustive travels, in countless airports, bus terminals, and railway stations, was a large body-sized suitcase called Letitia. Perhaps it was due to the circumstances of my birth, in the midst of sectarian violence in Northern Ireland, and my own family's trauma, that during my years of transience, I was inexplicably drawn to places with dark histories. Could it be because I've called so many brutally scarred locations home? Like Berlin, Singapore, Nicosia, Manila, Seoul, where my home and art studio burned to the ground, and the high plains of West Texas, where I was left for dead, that I can somehow taste the residual, lingering misery of war, turmoil, and grief. On this dark, blood-sodden earth, I have stood endlessly on the same soil, sand, and stone, where many people were extinguished before their time, often in the most grotesque of circumstances, suffering such injustices that their spirits cannot move on. On the wind I heard the moans of trapped souls seeking lost loves. In countless holy places, the prayers of the forgotten faithful still soak every surface and flutter from the walls like the wings of 10,000 moths. My skin prickled as the spirits of the damned crowded closely around me. In my obsessive travels, I ran my hands over the ancient ruins of Baalbek. I stood in the halls of abandoned Armenian monasteries and churches, in the shadow of Mount Ararat. I sought out the greatest of the trees, witnesses to all of man's crimes, placing my hands and ears to their gnarled trunks and gathering their leaves and fallen bark. I followed ghostly footprints in the snow that swirled beneath the cedars of Basho's beloved Koyasan. On the high road to Taos, I heard the ghosts of crying coyotes in an enchanted land once ruled by jaguars. In Goa, stained by the misery of the Inquisition, I dreamt of Nalanda. In Egypt, for so long my second home, I listened to midnight's moonlit silence in the Mamluk mosques of Cairo. I trailed my hands in the waters of the Mother Nile. I watched dust devils dance in the funerary desert temples of dead queens and pharaohs in Thebes. And I descended into the heart of great pyramids, and in tomb robber tunnels, I was surrounded by the bones of noble corpses. I do not doubt that the magic, curses, and broken dreams in each place left an indelible mark on my mind and soul. They have accumulated inside me. Did they infect me or empower me in their yearning to speak of their stories through the dust I inhaled and that still clings to me? But beware, concealed among the dead are other entities. They masquerade as ghosts or lonely spirits, emerging from cracks, crevices, and unholy ruptures. In assorted disguises, they are not as they appear. Pray to your God that they will never reveal their true forms to you. In my journeys, I saw and was seen by many such creatures. They scented the paths I had travelled. I protected myself as best I could, with talismans and prayers. I feel some of these spectres pursue me to this day, approaching me in nightmares and oblique shadows. It was only a matter of time before they began to influence my writing. Episode 16 of Baratanak. Part 2. A Stranger. Robed Merchant of the Red Lands. The Great Temple of Baal. Carthage, Africa. 420 BC. 10 days before sailing for Baratanak. With deliberate rhythm and her chin held high, the priestess navigated through the torchlit cloisters at the heart of the soaring temple building. Her shadow melted after her, leaping between the halos of blazing torches. Increasing her pace, she swept through angular, somber spaces of polished white marble. Incense had pooled there, so thickly that eddies and knots of smoke churned in her wake. From the corner of her eye, she glimpsed the dark smudge of her shadow dancing in the flickering light. When she halted, steps from an immense ornate door, it froze a second after her. Look at it crouch, anticipating my next action. Emishmoon, High Priestess of Baal, paused and surveyed the lofty cedarwood door's painted blue frame, edged with aged green copper. Its broad panels alternated between intricate wooden carvings and bronze inlaid scenes of various adversaries in the heart of battle. In addition to the warriors of every nation, her eyes travelled over lions pierced by the horns of wounded aurochs, wolves surrounding herds of red deer, and a leopard leaping for the neck of an ostrich. Grimacing gargoyles and tortured demons punctuated every scene. Now more than ever, their contorted faces appear trapped and straining to escape, thought the priestess, clad in long dark robes. With one hand she steadied her complex headpiece. Its uncovered wood and bone frame was held together by thin strips of leather and woven wicker. Two barely clothed, blinded and deaf temple slaves anticipated Emishmoon's approach through the floor's vibrations. As was customary, they pulled open the great doors exactly 10 seconds after she stopped, motionless. They whispered barely perceptible prayers as she continued past. The sightless slaves did not see her shadow and naturally hesitate behind her, but they felt its presence in the pit of their stomachs. As it slunk through the door's narrowing gap, they recoiled, goosebumps rippling over their skin. In its wake, a nearby torch strangely flickered green. Glimpses of sunlight beckoned the priestess forward. Its brilliance invaded the space from the edges of several hanging folds of geometrically patterned purple textiles. Raising an arm, she stepped forward and pushed the fabrics aside. 200 paces directly ahead, at the end of a sacred pathway, the priestess smiled to see the heads of 9 towering metal figures. The holy Tophet ovens. What glory! Each of the holy ovens stood 5 men high and gleamed under the clear sky. Composed of steel, silver and bronze, containing tin sourced from Baratanak, the backs of their lucent heads were tall enough to be spied from the streets outside the temple. Emishmoon whispered a prayer to the grandest figure, Baal, the god of the sky and weather, famine or feast. "The crops and rains failed at your whim," she muttered. Artisans had fashioned his exquisite, lifelike details from the ringlets in his thick beard to his noble nose and sagely lined forehead. Seated on his throne, his wise and paternal eyes stared directly at the priestess. 2 roaring maned lions made up the arms of his luxuriously appointed royal seat. During countless ceremonial occasions, she had admired the skillfully sculptured, patterned cloak and tunic that attired her lord in his repose. "See how the circle of sacred ibis feathers crown his shoulder-length hair, with his virile ram's horns curled beneath them." Tanit, Baal's beguiling consort and goddess of creation and destruction, was seated alongside him, sculpted in bronze and copper. Her Athenian-style hair was decorated with sheaves of wheat, while upon her head was the sphere of the sun, topped with a wide, inverted crescent moon. Triangular earrings hung from both of her earlobes, and below her beatific smile, the folds of her Doric tunic disappeared into the folds of 2 prodigious ibis wings that swathed her lower body. 2 lionesses posed passively at her feet. The remorseless hunters of their pride, thought Emishmoon, noting how they wore the same smile as their exalted mistress. To the priestess, Tanit's impressive Tophet oven also represented her other incarnation, Astarte, the moon goddess of war and sexual power. The holy couple were flanked by more ovens in the form of seated figures. Only 1, Melkart, stood on splayed feet. The ancient god of the prominent Phoenician city of Tyre, exalted among many things for his discovery of the valuable dye that gifted the Phoenicians their rich purple robes. His worship had forever demanded the regular burning of innocence. Like Baal, he was bearded, but wore a wide, pointed, almost pharaonic hat. Beneath this, his narrowed eyes stared ahead with cold, vengeful determination. The sun burned across his gleaming, naked torso, defining his muscled physique. A loincloth barely disguised the rise of his genitals between the slabs of his powerful tree-trunk thighs. Close to Melkart, one Tophet oven was ornamented with the feathered head and long beak of a holy ibis. The others were comprised of a large horned mountain goat, a roaring lion, a lioness, a horse, and a wolf shaped like Anubis. A patrol of three thick-set male mandrill monkeys caught Emishmoon's eye as they ambled along the heights of the cathedral walls behind the Tophet sanctuary. Naturally muscled, their vivid cerulean snouts, cyanic arses, and crimson scrotums were a clear contrast against the tops of the iridescent white eggshell lime walls, which were influenced by the zigguratic manners of Babylon. Raised from birth to believe they were human, the temple's baby mandrills suckled from the breasts of slave girls. Each guarded the temple complex with the dexterity and individual strength of five men, while brandishing fangs more fearsome than those of a mountain leopard. The most dominant among them had thin gold bands winding around their limbs, fashioned like hooded Egyptian cobras. The great temple was constructed close to the cliffs of the Middle Sea. Whether they faced the Middle Sea or inland, the patrolling mandrills looked over the honeycomb of stone dwellings favoured by the city's middle and lower classes. Large fortified mansions and smaller temples punctuated the palm-lined avenues that cut through these neighbourhoods, but the widest were reserved exclusively for the high-caste nobles and priestly classes who sped back and forth between the great temple and outlying wealthier parts of the city. The treeless roads for the common folk were dark, narrow, and cluttered with horses, carts, and all the hawkers of commerce to be found in an imperial city at its zenith. The reason for the temple's location among the labouring class was taxation. Daily, swathes of merchants set up their stalls at Carthage's main markets, held in broad squares and promenades that abutted the temple's high white walls. A share of every purchase on temple grounds is thus due to the anointed servants of Baal, Emishmoon was often heard to remind the tax assessors. The cloistered nobility would dispatch their servants and slaves to procure supplies among the unwashed masses. They fought through the hordes of eager citizens and visitors who flocked to haggle and gossip in every language of Africa, Europa, and the Middle Sea. Emishmoon once derided the scene as a swarm of pickpockets, thieves, and fake cripples, human parasites from every race and nation. She revealed how she would observe from the temple walls as they fell upon their prey, the public, while clouds of winged vultures circled above, always watching. As the priestess stepped past the last purple curtain, the marble tiles and azure sky glared with such intensity they seemed bleached to a single irradiant white. Are my eyes to be burned in their sockets? She paused at the first two steps of the 20 that led to an adjoining building, where the blackening heads of that day's bovine sacrifices were bloodily exposed to view. Their huge white horns curved towards the sky. Drying rivulets of brown gore ran down the pedestals, pooling below the empty staring eye sockets of seven giant bull aurochs. Emishmoon raised the vellum scrolls in her hand, in a vain attempt to shield her watering eyes. She rarely ventured into the midday sun. It was in this state of denuded senses that she heard a soft, inquiring voice beside her. "Priestess, most holy," the man's voice asked, "if I may kindly beg a moment of your blessed time." While turned away from the source of the voice, the priestess stretched a scarf of shimmering black muslin up over her face and headdress. With this smooth and practiced motion, she followed an important custom. The scarf's edges were weighted with cowrie shells and had been wrapped around the neck of her long black gown. In that moment of envelopment, hidden from view by fabrics, she became a formless silhouette. If faun, dryad, or unkind shapeshifter had walked in her stead, none would have been the wiser. Aside from achieving anonymity by placing the fabric over her woven wicker headdress, she gained an extra 3 hands in stature. This heightened her singular black form, making her appearance far more intimidating. And where the headdress flared out to a wide, flat crown, it unnaturally broadened her head considerably. From within her veiled world, the priestess was at liberty to peer out, but from without, her face remained obscured from scrutiny. Within the holy temple's boundaries, it was sacrilege to see the eyes of anointed ones, and, by that act, gain excessive unpaid blessings. "This is a privilege reserved only for those who have sworn vows to Baal," she thought, "and suffered to have his laws tattooed across their worthless earthly skin, or, of course, paid just and proper tribute to the temple's treasury." With her ears trained to the hallowed voices of the great temple's clergy, she ignored the stranger's voice and took a stride forward. "Please, priestess," came his request again, with heightened urgency, "if I may speak with you." "Identify yourself and what it is you desire here," she responded tersely, turning towards the man, "so that I may know the reasons for this impertinence. Can you not see that I walk between the sanctuaries of the sun and the moon on holy business?" She examined him as best she could from under her veil, but he was hardly more than a silhouette himself. His voice, it has a spark of the familiar. "Yes, yes, priestess, and I beg your forgiveness for any transgression," he said in humble sycophancy. Varying depths of shadow fell from the temple roofs to the ground. In the darkest shadow he lurked, flush against the stones of the soaring wall. "Reveal yourself," the priestess demanded, peering down towards his hands. "Does he have a weapon?" With the numbers of sacrifices in the temple, it certainly wouldn't have been the first untimely death within the walls, but the usual method was incineration. And she, of all, would have been exceedingly difficult to dispatch. Instinctively, her hands remained ready to seize the daggers that hugged each of her thighs beneath her robes. The figure still eschewed the unforgiving light. His robes and silhouette obscured what appeared to be some kind of dark, metal-edged receptacle or box held closely to his side. "Do not fear, priestess. I am but a simple desert merchant," he said, seeming to discern her thoughts. "In the close confines of the city for but one day." "Oh, merchant," she said, laughing, "I have no fear of you. But this is still impertinence. What brings you now into my presence, away from your unclean commerce? These transepts are reserved for those of holy cloth, not the caste of trinket sellers. You should not be here." "It is true, I come to Carthage seeking blessings, but with exceptional wares to hawk from isolated places of sun-scorched desolation." As he spoke, he held high the box that had been obscured by his side. The priestess passed her eyes across its crimson leather and saw that the metal upon its edges was richly ornate silver work. Accomplished craftsmanship, but not worth my time. "Isolated places of sun-scorched desolation," she said with a laugh. "How novel! Merchant, you describe almost the entirety of northern Africa beyond our fertile lands of Carthage. I bid you good day. She gathered up her hem to continue her path. No, please don't leave, he begged, raising his voice. I will admit, I crossed the palms of your guards with good coin to gain passage to these cloisters. But some of my... He paused, sucking in his breath. Some of my, trinkets, he exhaled, are of interest especially to high castes as exalted as your blessed self. I thought as much, she spat. A trespasser. You should know that those guards will be lashed harshly for your folly. As she spoke, the man bowed again, deeper in reverence. So tell me, trinket seller, why should your base business interest a grand priestess of Baal? O priestess, indeed I am but a lowly devotee, he said. Again his voice pricked with some unplaceable slither of cognition within her ear. To be in your presence is rich blessing enough, he went on. I merely hold out hope of further, shall we say, indulgences, and I bring ample payment for them. You confuse me, merchant. Do you approach me now as a seller or a buyer? Both, he replied. A vendor of choice goods and a purchaser of religious indulgences for a most influential patron. At this point, the crimson box rocked from left to right as the priestess squinted from inside her tinted veil. Is some wild creature of good omen trapped within? Perhaps an albino civet cat worth much gold? Her keen eye then passed to the merchant. Though still shrouded by shadow and her veil, she spied his common brown robes. The temple treasury will open at sundown, she said, her lip curled in derision. The scribes will accept your money and assign the relevant indulgence for your budget. Or you may touch the cloth that holds the holy bones for a fee. With that she bowed her head and turned to leave. But what I offer is for your personal blessing is a most uncommon treasure and a tool possessed by no other, the merchant called after her, flustered. Only you, the fairest and most blessed amongst all Baal's clergy, may deign even to look upon its fearful raging powers. And the reputed beauty of the priestess Emishmoon exceeds all others. The priestess halted in mid-step, then turned to face him again. He knows my name, she thought. Although with my fame from Elche it is not surprising, though that said, he only caught a brief glimpse of me. How would he know just from that? Not only had the merchant succeeded in appealing to her vanity, more importantly, he had piqued her interest in what advantage his possession might bring her. Like all Baal's high clergy, the priestess was obsessed with matters of rank. But beyond all else, she was infatuated with gold. For the last time, step out from the shadows, merchant, she ordered, striding back towards him. She was surprised to feel her pulse quicken, as if on the verge of some great discovery. But of what, she knew not. What is it you offer for such unseemly expectations of Baal's sacred bounties? She demanded, her hand crushing the vellum scroll. Tattoos across the back of her hand rippled with anticipation. Now that I might come closer, dear priestess, I will kindly show you, the man teased. What I offer is not to be seen by all eyes, so I tarried here in shadow. Prying, greedy personages might seek to deny you the revelation I bring you, or indeed steal it for themselves. Approach, she ordered. With his feet hidden beneath his robe, the merchant seemed to glide forward from the deepest shadow into one of lesser darkness. But he was still several shades from the sunlight that fought to burn her covered head. With his flattery still in her ears, the priestess yielded to cheap vanity and asked, So, merchant, how do you conceive me to be so beauteous? Is my grace much spoken of among the people? All I have blessed you with is a fleeting glimpse of my noble profile at most. Before he answered, she saw his chest rise and fall. He savours the scent of the rare floral oils on my skin. The merchant drew closer. Her breath stilled his unnaturally black, bloodshot eyes. Ah, they flash with an easy cruelty, she thought. Coal and indulgently heavy rings of crushed galena and malachite surrounded them. What vanity! She recognised the time-consuming methods by which those blacks, greys and greens had been applied. The rest of the man's face remained concealed by a turban, wrapped like the Tuareg warriors, raiders from shifting sands and plunderers of salt, ivory and diamonds. The Tuaregs shunted slaves in both directions across the dunes, unfortunates from lands north of the Middle Sea and those from the south, from across sand seas. And other less precious items too, won by plundering the great camel trains that threaded across the infinite sand seas of the desert. But he was no Targi. Her latent niggling hunch returned. I have gazed into those eyes before, but when, where? Somehow perceiving her thoughts, the merchant spoke before she did. Do I see a spark of recognition flutter upon your face, priestess? What an accolade that I should be memorable to one as exalted as yourself. Really, merchant? Effusive praise indeed, she said circumspectly. There was no doubt in her mind that she warranted such flattery, but she anticipated further revelations about his presence. And may I add my sincere congratulations that your relative youth did not inhibit your brisk elevation through Baal's holy hierarchy. He hesitated, then continued. Usually such sacred circumstances would be beyond the wildest dreams of a poor orphan. Never mind one peddled to Carthage at the age of 5 from the more colourful desert slums of Sect Am, within sight of the very oracle of our moon. Yes, such a colourfully confected heritage would indeed attract gossip, were it true, she said, her pulse quickening while her voice lowered at his words. She felt a threat was implicit. But you must have my roots confused with another, she said, bluster in her tone. Though, like all citizens, I love Africa, I am of exalted Carthaginian blood, as pure as the day my pious ancestors sailed from Sidon. I have never walked in the demon shadows of Sect Am. Well, I must apologize, he said. Perhaps the guards pointed me to a second priestess with whom you share the same name. No, she asserted. There is but one. So I hoped. I suspected you had a familiar air about you, merchant. He watched the mass of her headdress turn slowly in each direction as she made sure nobody was watching. Thank you for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode, then please subscribe. I must leave you now, but do not despair. If you listen to the next installment, the curse cannot harm you, but you must believe. Now pull the blanket over your head and be quiet. You are not alone. Shh.